Good morning and afternoon, everyone, and Happy New Year. Welcome back to EMForums.org, and we are very glad you could join us today. I am Amy Sebring, and will serve as your host and moderator. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. If you need assistance, please select the Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you via private chat. Now, as you may know, the National Weather Service is in the process of installing the new dual polarization radars at forecast offices across the country. These provide enhanced capabilities, and we think it is a good idea for emergency managers to have at least a basic understanding. In researching this topic, I came across the NWS Warning Decision Training Branch and the resources they offer, and we are very glad they accepted our invitation to join us today. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Now, we are recording, and today's recordings and a copy of the slide deck will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Andrew Wood works with the University of Oklahoma Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies, or CIMS, on assignment with this training branch. Andy has led the dual polarization radar training for NWS partner outreach efforts for the past 4 years. Please see today's background page for further biographical information and links to related resources that will be mentioned during the program. Welcome, Andy. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Okay. I'm very glad to be here today. And as Amy said, I work for the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and I am co-located with the Warning Decision Training Branch and do a lot of work with them in developing their training. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about WDTB and some of the resources we have available online that emergency managers might find useful, in particular talking about our dual polarization radar training efforts. So with that, let me proceed a little bit, and you can see this motley crew here is our branch, and we are a mixture of federal contractor and University of Oklahoma employees, and what we do with the Warning Decision Training Branch is develop and deliver training on the whole integrated process of warnings in the National Weather Service. And I'll get into some of the details of that in a little bit, but we really do try to look at the process as a whole. And that's a nice little mission statement, but when it gets into the actual practice of it, what we really do, we teach the science, technology, and human factors of radar interpretation as well as the general warning process. You would think, talking about radar, that it would specifically be severe weather warning operations, which we do a lot of. That's kind of our bread and butter. But we do quite a bit also with flash flood warning operations as well as winter weather warning operations. And our mantra, so to speak, is when we develop our training, we work very much on base data interpretation, and in doing so, helping forecasters build expertise and to maintain situation awareness during warning operations. So just to kind of give you an overview, WDTB is part of the Office of, it's the Office of Climate, Water, and Weather Services, or OCWIS, which is located in Weather Service headquarters. But we are one of three federal agencies in OCWIS. The Warning Decision Training Branch is located in Norman, Oklahoma, but there's also the Forecast Decision Training Branch in Boulder, Colorado, as well as the National Weather Service Training Center in Kansas City. In addition to those three federal agencies, we also have a partnership with Comet up in Boulder, where they also develop quite a bit of training that gets incorporated into Weather Service training. So we that's kind of the big umbrella of the Weather Service training division there, just so you can kind of have all that in perspective. Now, as I said earlier, we do science, technology, as well as human factors training. And the dual pole training is a good example of melding at least the science and the technology training of what we do. And with the dual pole training, or it's dual polarization technology, a lot of us meteorologists, as a shorthand, we call it dual pole. So you'll probably hear me go back and forth between the two quite a bit. It's kind of a shorthand thing to say it that way. But the dual polarization technology upgrade is the biggest upgrade to the ADAP since it was first fielded in the 90s. And so it was a big process to try to identify what training was needed, how we were going to deliver it, what was going to be the scope of it. And I'll get more into those details in a little bit. But that is a prime example of the type of science and technology training that we do. But, you know, we talk about human factors, and when you talk about a science agency in the government, some people may think, well, why are you focusing on human factors? Well, human factors are a really big part of the warning process. We've done quite a bit of work with root cause analysis and postmortems of different events. And, for instance, with tornadic events, we have found through working with forecast offices that when you look at the factors that contribute to tornado events and, say, missed events, human factors is a significant portion of what can be taught to and corrected that might help prevent these missed events in the future. Certainly science and technology are part of the puzzle, but human factors is really a big part of it. So we really try to emphasize that as much as we can when it's relevant. And so just to provide an example of what we do in terms of human factors training, one of the courses that we developed this past year is Communicating Risks in High Impact Events. And what we've done is we've talked with forecast offices and kind of taken their stories and linked them together and try to put that into the context of the broader crisis communication cycle, how they can better work with partners like you all with the emergency management community, but in other communities as well, and trying to do a better job communicating what we know in a way that's relevant to you. And a lot of times doing this type of training can be challenging because it really is about communication and getting to know who you're working with and building those relationships. And as you'll see in the types of training that we do, that's not always the easiest thing to do, especially for those of us in the technology field. It's definitely been a learning process as we've built up the expertise in that area. Now, in addition to focusing on science, technology, human factors, our ultimate goal is to impact warning performance in a positive way. And so how do we do that? Well, our focus tends to be to really try to look at what are the outcomes we want to accomplish and then build learning objectives off of that, and also to a degree build our performance objectives off of that as well. And one example, I think this actually came from one of our service assessments during a flash flood event that was pretty big. I think it impacted most of the Southeast a couple years ago. We were really looking at ways that Weather Service forecasters could improve their performance and how they deliver their products. And, for instance, one of the big things that's come along in the last few years is the use of the flash flood emergency wording in a flash flood warning product. And one of the things that was found as a result of that service assessment is that there were more events that could be classified in a way that using that language would be beneficial to partners than was actually being used. So it was that tool was being underutilized. So in the training that we put together, we tried to clarify when it was appropriate to use that type of wording. And lo and behold, after that training was released, there was a big bump up to probably a more appropriate level because of that. So that was one way that we impacted performance based on the training. So we try to focus in on things like that as much as we can to do the best job we can to help you all. Now, in terms of the type of training we develop and how we reach people, we utilize a lot of techniques. We've, you know, most of you are probably used to the old in-residence training, and I think that's still most people's favorite way to attend training and participate. But as you can see, that's actually a really small portion, at least in terms of students, of what we do. And a lot of that is just really just related to costs and the way things are. 20 years ago when we did the original ADAD training, that was how we did everything within residence. But now it is really a much smaller subset. So we do rely more on instructor-led training, much like these webinars. We do quite a bit of that here. We also, pretty much our bread and butter is web-based training, which is how we now, whenever we need to reach the entire Weather Service forecast community, that's pretty much how we do it, as well as developing simulations for working different types of events. And every Weather Service forecaster who has warning responsibility is supposed to complete 4 simulations per year. So that's another way that we can reach the community as a whole. But that's it's very time-intensive, so we reach everybody, but it's still not always the easiest way to get to everybody. So the web-based modules really tend to be our bread and butter in terms of providing the most breadth of training that we have available. Now, that sort of thing is actually good for you all, though, because that means that a lot of the training that we have is available online that people can take. And I just put up a handful of examples of training that certainly may be applicable to the emergency management community. Some of them are things like the dual polarization radar training, and I have that link there. But some of it is also related to the human factors training that we do. One course that we've done in the last few years is the integrated warning team, which is based on work that we've done at different conferences where we really try to get the Weather Service forecasters, the emergency managers, and the media to try on different roles, and so you kind of walk a mile in the other person's shoes and get a better understanding of what their job is like and what they need to do. And so we've kind of developed training on that. We also have the course that I mentioned earlier, that communicating risks and high-impact events. Certainly, I think that could be beneficial to you all because you can see what we are training to our own staff about you and your needs during these types of events. So it can, you can certainly see how we're doing things. But also other things that's probably maybe a little bit more science and technology based is EF scale training. Certainly, I know that's probably something that would be significant to a lot of you who deal with severe weather and tornadoes. In particular, I know this would be useful with the Weather Service when they're going out to survey an event. If you have a good rudimentary understanding of the EF scale and how it works, we can benefit from you all knowing what area is most likely going to have the highest rating, just so that we can streamline the process of where to send people to survey an event, find out where the worst damage is, and it also kind of helps us to stay out of your hair. That way we can go see what's bad, report it to who we need to, and then we kind of stay out of your way as much as possible. So I think there's some mutual benefit there. And then lastly, something that I don't know if a lot of people understand is the role that wind farms play in data quality with the radar. And so we put together a briefing. It's really more for the wind energy community to help them understand, but I think it's also something that emergency managers might benefit from, especially as more and more wind farms start popping up around the country. You may see some data quality issues and not quite understand what's going on in those areas, and so you kind of see what might impact understanding your weather data around those wind farms. That can be really helpful. So that's just kind of a general overview of WDTD and what we do. And so now I just wanted to talk a little bit about our dual polar training initiatives. As I said earlier, dual polarization technology, dual poles are kind of interchangeable terms. Just the meteorologist and me, it's just too easy to revert back to the acronyms and technical speak. So I apologize if I'm going back and forth between them. Like I said, I really try to spell that out as best I can. But the dual polarization technology upgrade to the ADAD is the most significant change to the radar since it was initially fielded. And I think one of the challenges to it is basically all the radar data and products that you had before are still there. All the dual polarization technology is just an add-on to what was there before. So in theory, you could keep doing what you did before, and you should see almost no impact based on dual pole. But you have all these additional products that are available, and it's a process of trying to get people to take that new data and integrate it into how they're already working. And there's benefits to that, definitely, because it allows you to kind of take things baby step-wise and just piece by piece add things. But it's also one of those situations that whenever you're kind of confronted with something new like this, and if you can keep doing things the way you used to do them, it's really easy to do that. So people may not necessarily gravitate to this new information, no matter how helpful it is. So there's kind of pros and cons there with this. Now, just to kind of give you an understanding of where we're at with this, the dual pole upgrade, I have this map of the sites around the country. The red sites are the radars that have already been upgraded. So you can see most of the country has been upgraded. Most of the sites that are left are either in the central U.S., the Midwest, or Hawaii, Alaska, and some other locations. The gray dots that are on there are the sites that are currently down being upgraded. And then the blue sites are the ones that are left to be upgraded over the next several months. So you can see that the kind of the area in the south central part of the U.S. is where the upgrades are currently happening. Now, when we started working on the training solution for dual pole and how we were going to reach everybody and train them, one of the things I think we realized very early on was, yes, the Weather Service community was going to need this training, but we really needed to take a look at partners and what we were going to do for them. The last time we tried to put together a training initiative of this size really was back in the 90s with the original radar, and we realized that it's just a different world. There's so much more information available. Users are going to have much better access to this data, although it's been a little slow going to this point, but it's definitely easier for users outside the Weather Service to access radar data now than it was back then. So we realized that we needed to provide as much information as we could to people so that as this data became available, they might be able to use it in a positive way. So, yes, we have our Weather Service operations course, but I was going to talk a little bit about our partners training and that initiative. And even in that role of when we talk about training to partners, we even realized there we had two different needs. We have trained meteorologists outside the Weather Service, and how would we provide a training to them? But we also have the non-meteorologist decision makers, which a lot of the emergency management community who fit into that role, who, you know, they're fairly savvy and they have experience with radar data, but they may not necessarily have the same meteorological background as a trained meteorologist. So we needed to be able to provide relevant training to both of those communities and help them as much as we could. So we realized pretty early on that even in this role, we were still going to have two different training solutions that we needed. So what we decided to do is for the trained meteorologists is we made the same course that was available for the Weather Service forecasters available to them. The one thing we needed to do was create a separate introduction to the course because the media and other private companies, they're going to have different interfaces for looking at weather data, and they're going to have some other differences in mission and whatnot that in the Weather Service training we kind of take for granted. So we needed to highlight those differences. So as they went through the course, they would understand these things and realize, okay, some of this may not be 100% applicable to me and my job, but it's going to be fairly close. Now, in terms of the partners, that was going to be a different animal. We really tried to focus more on what dual polarization technology is. And unlike most science training where the focus tends to start at the base science level as a fundamental and build up, we actually kind of reversed it. And we tried to focus more, what are the benefits of this new technology, and then use that as kind of a foundation of training to build off of so that people could, they may not necessarily start off right away trying to interpret the data, but at least you would have an understanding of what it is and why it's important, and then kind of build to the actual products from there. One of the things that's also kind of important, especially with some of the benefits that come along with dual pole that are significant, we really also wanted to make sure people understood what aspects of the radar hadn't changed. There are certain limitations that are significant that people need to realize are still there. So we tried to highlight both of those things. And then as an end result, after all that, we did try to at least provide a few basic applications for non-meteorologists who might want to use this data. So just to kind of highlight some of what this is, if nothing else for the emergency management community, dual polarization technology helps because it helps the Weather Service do a better job. It will help them provide better service to you. It gives them a lot more confidence about certain things that they're looking at. It's just especially things like hail during winter weather events, even tornadic events. There's just a lot of things where we've already seen significant improvement that help forecasters understand what's going on better and help them change how they communicate what they know to partners. Now, of course, some experienced EMs may be able to make use of this data in the right circumstances, and really our guidance to you is the most important thing about dual pole is you have to use them in context of other radar products. So if you're comfortable using reflectivity and velocity, whenever you're looking at dual polarization products, whether it's base data or algorithms, you need to look at them in the context of what you're comfortable with reflectivity and velocity. It's also really important to know their limitations, especially when you're talking about things like winter weather and where, say, snow and rain is being indicated in the radar products. Understanding some of the physical limitations that a radar has is really important when it comes to actually determining precipitation type at the ground. And as with all things, it's really important when working with the Weather Service to really trust your local experts in terms of communication and information sharing. They are, while a lot of offices are still coming up to speed, obviously some offices still don't have the dual pole in their area, they have been going through the training, they are getting experience on a daily basis with the new data, and I think they can definitely help you out with some of this if you are taking on using this data on a regular basis. Now, in terms of our partner training for non-meteorologists, some of the things that we have in there, we talked a little bit about how the dual pole radar works. And we really do try to keep things where it's not technical. It's, you know, I kind of use some kind of like a slideshow of images of the radar sending out a beam out to some precipitation. It can have a variety of precipitation there as that radar pulse gets reflected back. And just kind of highlighting the difference of, say, the old legacy radar data, which gave you information about size because it would scan things horizontally versus dual pole, which gives you more information about the general shape of precipitation as well as in the variety because it scans both horizontally and vertically. That additional information just really helps better understand things because of that. We also try to talk about the benefits, obviously. We try to keep things relatively clear and just kind of focus on a few things that are kind of the most important to partner community, one of which, or before I get into that, is, like I said earlier, in terms of building expertise, it's going to take time. So we see down the road in several years where all forecasters are going to be able to use this data, and we're going to have these clear benefits. But forecasters are still learning. There's a bit of a learning curve that comes with dual pole. So some of these benefits are still really in the process of being worked out. I know especially last year, because we had such a mild winter, I think forecasters, we kind of feel like we lost a year because there were so few winter events, especially with where the radars were situated, that we didn't get as much expertise last winter as we would have liked with dual pole out in the field. But, you know, hopefully after this winter, things will be a lot better and people will be a lot more comfortable using the data. But it's just things like that happen. It's going to be the same thing, say, with tornadoes. Last year was not the most active tornado year, so certain places that had them are a lot more comfortable with them, say, in the southeast, with some of the outbreaks they had, but there are other parts of the country where they didn't have any severe weather, at least tornado-wise at all. So it may take them a couple years before they've had some events to really feel like they've got the expertise they need to move forward. Now, talking about that, one of the things I kind of wanted to show this slide just as an example of the tornadic debris signature, because it became kind of a hot topic last year with forecasters, and it's something you all probably need to know, especially those of you, depending on what your media market's like, and how much they break in. I do think you're going to start hearing about this more in the media this coming spring. I know some of the providers of weather graphics to TV stations, they're trying to come up with ways of automating detection of tornadic debris signatures, so you'll probably see icons and things like that where they start talking about debris signatures and, okay, we're confirming a tornado's here. And I know that there may be a learning curve on the media side as well as on the emergency manager side, because if you're not going to know, is this, if you have local chase crews that go out, is this a person who's spotting it, or are you basing this off of the radar? There's just going to be a lot there that you all will probably want to be aware of as this becomes more and more prevalent. But really, from your point of view, because it's one of the things I know in our training, we're very optimistic about debris signatures and how they will help. It certainly does not diminish the need for local spotters. They're still by far the most important thing that we have in terms of spotting tornadoes and tracking, just because of some of the limitations of radar. But with the dual pole tornadic debris signature, one of the things that's really helped is in areas where you don't have spotters available, or where the tornado is not really visible, whether it's because it's rain wrapped or because it's at night. And it's going to be most beneficial as storms are closer to the radar. But what we're finding is that the range at which tornadic debris can be detected using dual pole data is actually a little better than we initially thought. We're still not really good about hard and fast rules about distance, because a lot of that it's just going to vary on some other factors. But it's at least fairly promising out to say about 50 nautical miles from the radar that if there's significant debris lofted by a tornado, that we would be able to detect it with the radar. But like I said, also, one of the things we want to talk about, too, is just some of the radar limitations. And we just, for instance, one of the things we like to remind people, with radars is they don't necessarily see at the ground. So far away from the radar, you're not going to see things very well that are near the ground. Likewise, close to the radar, you're not going to see things that are high aloft. So we try to include that information in the training on a handful of things just to remind people of that. So, that's just kind of like a little snippet of what's in the training. In terms of the partner training, the total duration of it is about 1 to 2 hours for the non-meteorologists, and then it's approximately, 6 hours or so for the meteorologists outside the Weather Service. So that kind of gives you an example of that. But just quickly in summary, the Warning Decision Training Branch provides training on the Weather Service warning process and the tools forecasters use during that. So there's a heavy focus on radar, but there's other technology things we do train on related to that. Most of the training we do is available online, and if you go to our website, you can find that. Emergency managers may find some of the training that we do useful. Some of you may find more of it useful than others. It just depends on your location and what your needs are. And I talked a little bit about the dual polarization technology upgrade, just because that's something that's probably going to affect most of you in some form or another in the emergency management community. So with that, there's my contact info, and I would be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Andy. A very good overview. Now, if we do have some questions or comments from our folks in the audience today, here are instructions to ask a question or make a comment. You're going to go to the Q&A panel, and I am going to actually close the chat panel at this point so that we won't get confused as to which one to put it in. But you just type your question or comment after you've selected host, and then just click on send or hit the enter key. And then I will just read any questions out loud over the bridge, and then our guests will respond to those. So you may enter your question or comment at any time. Andy, you already answered my question about how long does the training take. You said a couple of hours. Is it something that you can, stop and then go back to?
It is. The way the partner training is set up is there are three lessons. The first lesson is the longer one. It's about 45 minutes to an hour long, but I tried to chunk it in a way that if you did like one section of it and you needed to take a break, you could.
Gotcha.
And the software, if you're doing it on the same machine, one of the things that's nice is when you take it, if you close the browser and you come back to it, it should ask you, do you want to continue where you were? So as long as there aren't multiple people taking it on the same machine, it should help you get back to where you were when you first took it.
Okay, great. Okay, we do have a question from Michael Baldasser, but please forgive me, anyone, if I mispronounce your name. He asks, and I'm interested as well because we have a lot of them where I live. He says, briefly, what effects do wind farms have on radar depictions?
That is actually a great question. Wind farms, especially if you, like you said, if you have them in your area, they are very big and they are very reflective. So the radar picks up on them very well. One of the problems is the radar, they've gotten pretty good with the radar engineers about identifying ground clutter and being able to filter that out of the radar data that gets sent out. But part of the problem is to filter out the clutter, usually the two things that you need is for them to be stationary and to have no velocity component in the data. So it needs to not be moving, and the data needs to suggest that in the velocity data that it's not moving. So that way, just the way the algorithms are written to remove that signal from the data, it kind of needs that. Well, the problem with wind farms is when the turbines are spinning, they don't appear stationary. They appear to be moving. So as wind farms come online, the forecasters basically have to create special zones around the wind farm to basically make it filter out the signal as much as possible. Unfortunately, during certain types of weather, you can still see symptoms of the wind farm kind of pop up and be visible in the radar data. So depending on your location and where these things are, it can cause problems. I guess the other thing, too, is if the wind farm is close enough to the radar, even though you may be mitigating impacts of the wind farm in that particular location, there can be some beam blockage issues downstream that if it's very close to the radar.
Thank you. I hope this is not a silly question, but does the dual pole help identify like flocks of migrating birds, those kinds of things better?
It actually does. There's a lot of ornithology people who are interested in looking at dual pole data, and this may sound strange, but there's a lot of stuff that we saw on radar in the past that, you know, we would look at it and like, okay, we don't think that's weather, so we're just going to kind of ignore it. But now with the dual pole data, it kind of helps you start to look at it and be like, okay, now what is that really? And, I mean, it's even to the effect that the dual pole data for, say, if it's an area where you think it's birds, the data will look different whether the birds are flying to or from the radar or if they're flying parallel to how the radar beam is sampling. So even the shape of the bird, that the whether it's, you know, sampling it head-on or sampling it looking at the wings flapping up and down, you can see a difference in the data from that.
I'll be done. Okay, I have a question from Timothy Marshall who asks, how do mountains and hills affect the dual-pole radar?
They affect it in they're affected in similar ways to the conventional radar data. You do get some beam blockage that can affect the data downstream of the mountains and hills. So you do have that problem there, and so both the base data and the algorithms can be impacted from that. There's at least one product called specific differential phase, which, without trying to get too technical, it's a product it's a proxy for how much liquid water is in the atmosphere where the radar sampling. So it's a very useful product for, say, heavy rain detection and possibly for flash flooding. The one thing that's really good about that product is it tends to be immune from some of these beam blockage issues. I mean, it will still be impacted somewhat downstream of mountains just because of some of the sampling issues, but it is more resilient than other radar products just because of how it's computed. So that's good. But things like the two big the other big base products for dual polarization technology are differential reflectivity, which looks at the difference between the vertical and horizontal reflectivity. If you look at that at all, one of the things you will notice is the differential reflectivity near hilly terrain will appear very negative, which would indicate that you have something oriented vertically that the radar is sampling, which I guess would sort of make sense when you're talking about hills and mountains. But, you know, so that's something that you might see artifacts with if you're actually looking at that data. Those are probably two of the bigger things.
Right. Speaking of rain, does the dual pole help improve the accuracy of, you know, estimating rainfall amounts?
Sort of.
Sort of. Okay.
Well, in the big scheme of things, it should help significantly. What we have found so far, both from research on dual polarization radars before these were fielded and in what's been put out there, is radar detected rain that is below freezing, or I mean above the melt or below the melting layer where temperatures are above freezing. When it samples that precipitation, there seems to be some definite improvement in the amounts that are detected. Where things start getting tricky is when you start getting into the bright band and especially above the bright band. And part of that is the algorithm that was developed using the dual pole data is still in its infancy, and it really just needs more data and more research to be done on how to kind of tune it, especially tune it locally to get the best quality estimates. And so that's one of those things that I think that benefit will be there, but it's going to take a few years before it gets there.
Right.
So there's definitely, especially during the winter season, that's where it seems to have the biggest problems, is when the freezing level is very low, and so it's sampling snow and frozen precipitation higher up, and if it's mostly rain at the surface, then your amounts can get kind of skewed.
Right. So they'll basically conduct more research to collect the data on actual rainfall accumulations and compare them and use that to fine tune.
They're hoping to do that over the next few years. I mean, obviously, right, with funding situations being what they are, it may take a little longer, but that's kind of their number one priority in terms of future upgrades to the radar for dual pole.
Has there been any outreach to the spotter community about this?
There has been some. I mean, the training we did, we tried to take more of the national tack to make stuff available, and we've tried to reach out through some of the typical weather service vehicles. Like there's an article or a newsletter that they put out called Aware, where we've tried to reach out a little bit there. But we've tried also, because so many of the local offices, the warning coordination meteorologist is in charge of that, we've tried to work with them as well for their spotter community. So they really are kind of leading the way on it, and then we're just trying to provide materials to help them do their job.
Very good. Okay, I got a couple more questions here. Larry Lovering, he says, and I don't know what this word is, I hope you do, what is the difficulty of detecting virga of rain or snow versus the precipitation falling all the way to the ground?
Larry asked a great question. What virga is it's basically precipitation that's falling but isn't reaching the ground.
Uh-huh.
So it is a difficulty issue, and that's a limitation with radar that's always going to be there. And it's actually one of the points that we make in the training, is especially because it's not even just whether you have precipitation falling and whether or not it's reaching the ground, but there's also the issue with dual pole and precipitation type. You may be detecting frozen precipitation, snow, at a certain location, but because the atmosphere is different below the radar beam, it's actually melted or, say, it's sleet at the surface. And so, you know, those are things where forecasters are going to have to take radar data with surface observations, with model data, and all of that to help them better understand what they're seeing and then taking that message and communicating it to the public. So it is a difficulty, but it's the thing about the dual pole, it gives you more information at the point that the radar is sampling, and so it helps the forecaster. You know, Virga is going to be Virga, and there's always going to be some issues with that, especially if you don't have surface observations in that area where the Virga might be occurring. But even with things like precip type, there's the dual pole data helps, but there's always going to be certain limitations there.
Well, I've learned a new word. Thank you very much. Okay. Trisha Chappell, she says, how does dual pole enhance or complement, quote, Doppler technology? This is a type of Doppler technology, is it not?
Yeah, well, and that is, with the Doppler radar, you had the even predating Doppler reflectivity data, but you also had the velocity information.
Right.
It helps, it complements it quite a bit in helping understand what we're seeing in a storm. For lack of a better way to do it, I think an analogy kind of helps a little bit. I tend to think of dual pole, pre-dual pole, when you had a Doppler radar, it's a little bit like a CAT scan. And when you add dual pole, it's more like an MRI. It's not to say that it's going to be conclusive information every time. It just gives you a clearer picture of what's going on. So the dual pole does not necessarily improve the velocity information specifically, but it does give you a better understanding of the storm features that you're looking at, so you have a better understanding of what's going on and trying to get things to make sense. I mean, given a little bit of time, I might be able to think of a few specific examples, but yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Well, I think that was a very good summary. I have a creative question from Lori Weaver, and she asks, can you speak a bit about how industrial stack discharges or hazardous material plumes can impact radar readings or perhaps even be tracked for response in emergency events?
Ooh. Well, I don't know of that many specific instances of industrial releases. What I can say is I have a bit of experience with fires and smoke plumes.
Oh.
And dual polarization data is actually really helpful with smoke plumes and fires. Fires, the nature of the data for a fire is very different from precipitation. It really stands out well in dual pole data. So if you had an industrial release that was either close to the radar, if, say, there was like a significant ash component or particulate component to it, and it got up high enough where the radar could sample it, I think there actually is some potential help that dual pole can help in terms of spotting and tracking it. Except I just haven't seen a specific case of it yet, so I would be optimistic, but just there's the part of me that I want to see it before I can say it for sure. But dual pole is really helpful with fires. It's very good with military chaff if you have issues with that in your area. Obviously, like I mentioned earlier about like wildlife, it's very good at identifying areas of non-precipitation from precipitation, especially when they're going on at the same time. We've actually had one case where we could track a fire as a line of thunderstorms moved past it. So you could still see the fire even though it was raining all around it.
Oh, amazing. That's interesting to know about the fires. I could definitely see some uses for that. What kind of feedback have you been getting, Andy? And I'm kind of particularly interested in what kind of participation you are getting from those private sector meteorologists.
I, it's one of those things, and I totally understand. Most of my interaction has been with meteorologists.
Right.
And so they really appreciate the training and understanding it better. They are just struggling with how to communicate the information in a way that they're used to. And I understand because if I had a good, clear-cut answer, I would provide it to them. And I just don't necessarily know. Like I was saying, I know at least one of the providers has been tinkering with an automated way of identifying debris signatures and making it where it would be kind of easily identifiable so that TV meteorologists could point those out. Like if they're zoomed into a storm and if they think a debris signature is there, they would have some sort of icon or something that they could put up. And I think that may start showing up this spring. It's been a while since I've heard about it. And, you know, when you start talking about the private sector, that's, you know, it gets a little muddy. But I've at least seen an early prototype of what something like that might look like at one point. So I just don't know for sure if they've moved forward with that or not. But for some of these products, depending on, say, even with something like a fire, it wouldn't surprise me if TV meteorologists start trying to actually show some of this stuff on TV. If it's something that can be easily shown in, like, a single image or two. The hard thing is because context is so important with this data that it can be difficult to show comprehensively what's going on in one or two images. And so that's part of where the problem comes with some of this.
I see. Do you want to mention one of the things I found on your website or links to the Storm of the Month webinars?
Yes.
Let's mention those.
Well, the Storm of the Month we started doing after the dual pole sites were being officially fielded. So we've done 15 of them, I think, so far. And what we do, it's just a way of doing information sharing, much like these webinars. And what it is they're short. We try to keep them at about 20 minutes. Now, the live sessions are only available to Weather Service staff, but we record them and put them online so that anybody could review them. And one of the things we try to do, we try to get people to just focus on either a single storm, or people may focus on two to three storms, but maybe a specific element of that storm related to using dual polarization technology. You know, like I think one we had, there was a fire and then a flash flood shortly thereafter, so they kind of look at some of the impacts of that. You know, there's just a variety of things. And it's, you know, we've focused some on tornadic debris signatures, fires, flash flooding. There was even a dust storm in Phoenix that filled up part of one. We really do try to introduce variety and try to make them timely in terms of the season that we do. But we try to keep them short. And one of the things that we do, it takes a little longer to post-process, but we record the primary session. And then as people go through the question and answers, we actually try to develop some additional add-on information if something comes up so that there's kind of additional learning that maybe in the Q&A session it didn't come out clearly, but we might have been able to summarize it in a way that, hey, you need to be able to understand this or you need to be aware of this information. So we try to make it a little bit more value added that way as well.
Good deal. We don't have any more questions, but just to kind of wrap up, going back to the training branch in general, do you have any know where any particular projects coming up in the future that you might be working on?
Oh, boy. well, it's with the dual polarization technology upgrade, that's been a big endeavor for our branch. Another big one is it doesn't necessarily impact the emergency management community a whole lot, is the Weather Service is in the process of upgrading their display systems. So we're doing quite a bit of technology training on that. I'm trying to think. We have a lot of training that we do that is kind of on an annual cycle. So it's, we kind of have, like, for new employees, we have a course for them that takes about 100 hours of training to complete. And so we update a lot that a lot. And then we have some other that are kind of follow-on to that training that we do. Oh, you stumped me on this one, Amy.
Oh, that's okay. Not a problem.
If
you have any afterthoughts, let us know. But we've got you bookmarked. We've got you linked. So we'll keep an eye on it. And if you ever want to come back and let us know what's going on, please let us know.
Yeah, that would definitely be sure. And it is, we have several employees that have some significant partner background. And for instance, actually, he's my office mate here, used to work for our state climatological service and did a lot of work with training emergency managers on radar interpretation with them. So he always kind of brings that emergency management perspective into what he does and kind of helps us remind things. So we try to keep you guys in mind when we're doing things a lot. So if anything else comes up that would be applicable to you all, I'd be glad to come back.
And I know you touched upon it, but as these this new technology is being deployed, there are those folks in the local weather forecast office, the warning coordinating meteorologists, that are doing this kind of outreach on a local level. So in addition to your contact information here, that's another person you might want to get in touch with. Am I correct?
Certainly, and especially one of the big, for a lot of people, their main outreach activities, they're really going to be kicking into gear over the next several months. So this is a great time to try to reach out to them. And a lot of it will be severe storm spotter classes, but you know, now is a real busy time for them, and they're going to be trying to reach out to everybody, and so there will be a lot for them to contact them about in the near future, I think.
Very good. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap it up for today. Thank you very much, Andy. On behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, we really appreciate you being with us today to share this valuable information. And we do wish you continued success as you move forward with your efforts in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that I could participate. And if people have questions, like I said, I think my email is in there. And if they can send me an email if they think of something, you know, a couple of days from now and have a question about the presentation, I'd be glad to answer it.
Very good. That's very kind of you. Folks, before you run off, please do take a moment to complete our feedback. And I finally this year have remembered to add 2013 to the form. Our next program is scheduled for January 23rd, when our topic will be a new report published by the National Academies Press, Disaster Resilience, a National Imperative. And our guest, we are very pleased to have the chair of the authoring committee and director of the University of South Carolina's Hazards and Vulnerability Research Institute, Susan L. Cutter. She has presented for us in the past, and we're delighted she's agreed to come back again. So please do make plans to join us then. Have a great afternoon, everyone, and have a great 2013. We are adjourned. Bye now.